Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com for comprehensive show notes, printable Halloween masks, book suggestions, or to just leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. And here's Bert.
Good day, fellow useful idiots. This is Brett. Today is the 23rd of July. Is this the first episode of this show you've ever heard? Hit stop right now. This isn't even the first episode in a series. Please go to our website, schoolsucksproject.com. Click the series menu. Find something that piques your interest. This is not the place to start. If you're a regular listener and you didn't hear part one, you're going to want to hear part one. As I recommended before, you also probably want to check out the Gnostic Media videos or the podcast that we are referencing throughout this series. And that is linked in the show notes as well. Let's get right to it. And in today's presentation, we will move through the next 20 minutes of the video, where Jan and Bill continue to discuss certain aspects of nonviolent communication, like the four D's of disconnected communication and the OFNR process, observations, feelings, needs, and requests. Here we go. Just not the same to be any more than all I am would be alive. I'm so full of love, I could burst apart and start. All right, so we're ready to jump back into this?
Yep.
All right. We are going to wind it back 2 minutes from where we left off last time, and I'll probably let this play a little bit.
You know, you got a person that's very attached to an idea, and I've confronted them. They're going to get upset. My stance is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the other person's emotional state is. If I'm stating knowledge that I've gained through the trivium, I've got a position and I'm stating my case, their emotion is irrelevant. What's relevant is the content of what they're saying to me.
However, if you're only focused on using this mealy-mouthed rhetoric and you're avoiding the general grammar and focused on catering to, presenting to their emotional sensitivities or disconnection, then you are misusing all of this, and it, you know, you should be called out for it.
Yeah. So in every step of the way here, we can draw a conclusion about the person that we're talking with, ignore their content, ignore their grammar, ignore their logic, whether it's valid or false, focus on them as a human being, their emotional state, their cognitive state that I'm assessing for myself based on this framework that I can never falsify, and then I can stand back and have a formula to now deal with them. It's sort of an empathetic stance. Talk about putting yourself in a disempowered place. That when you're in that conversation, operating from something like NBC, you're not even a person in the room. You are a formula of managing another person. You're
well
irrelevant
said.
At that point.
Right. Well said.
And you're not communicating with somebody. You're not being empathetic with somebody. You're managing them by your framework.
All right. That's as far as we made it last time. I'm just going to let it keep going here for another minute or two.
So.
Right. And you're trying to lead them to the conclusions that you want rather than basing conclusions on the general grammar itself.
Oh, well, you know, but all I want is what's the best for them. And because they're emotionally disconnected and irresponsible and don't take emotional responsibility, I know what's best for them.
Then, yeah, ad hominem, self-appealing ad veracundium fallacy. I mean, you go right down the list there.
And if they disagree with me, then they must not be at a place where they can see what's good for them in the first place.
Right.
So where's the mitts off? Where's the respect of the individual? Where's the respect that somebody can look at the same information that you have and have a different value set and draw a different conclusion and disagree with you?
Now, we should also realize that if they are looking at the same actual general grammar and not just your appeals to emotion, etc., that a contradiction is a lie or an error, and we should be able to remove those fallacies and come to the exact same conclusion with that information in the commons.
With one exception.
With one exception that if there's...
I would say that if there's ever disagreements, it comes down to one of two things. It's either definitions. There's a misunderstanding, or people are using different definitions, so it's a misunderstanding. Or it's not, if they don't share the same values. So you can have a person with a different value set look at the same evidence as you, and their logic will be different based on that value set.
However, if the person is rational and reasonable, you should be able to look into that value set and then understand that contradiction.
Yeah, but it's not always a contradiction. So I've seen this happen where you can have people with different value sets. They're both valid. They just have different priorities around life. And at that point, when you're in that point, you agree to disagree and go, you know what, I do get where you're coming from. And I do get that because you're 20 years old and want to party, and I'm a father and worry about my kids. We have different values. And walk away from that. And it's important because the marketplace of ideas is terribly important for society, for individuals, is to allow people to have their own views. It's not for me to manipulate you into my views.
Okay, that's a good place to hold. At the beginning of those 3 minutes that we listened to there, when they were talking about leading somebody to your conclusion, maybe this would be a question for Daryl. Are they speaking to some kind of specific experience that you know of, or is that just more of a generalization?
I can speculate.
Okay.
They are speaking of back and forth comments on Facebook with me.
Mm-hmm.
I can speculate that. I don't know for sure. I can say that, yeah, I use words to try to demonstrate what it is that I have to offer. And some people could say I'm trying to be persuasive with my words.
Yeah.
Aren't we all? I mean, isn't almost everyone trying to be persuasive with their words? So the difference is this. I'm claiming to use certain methods that I try to be upfront about, and I'm aware of various things, and I'm using these tools. Then there's the awareness that apparently Bill and Jan have about the tools that I'm using.
Okay.
So... you know, I think that they infer that the words behind my words were, I'm trying to convince you guys that I've got a good thing, and they didn't like that.
Or almost that if you don't embrace it, it's because you're defective, or you were viewing them as defective characters that needed to be guided through some kind of process. It seems like there's that mischaracterization. I mean, just what I know from experience. But then he also uses this phrase, mitts off, which in my opinion creates a false dichotomy, like you're either being authentic or you're doing nonviolent communication.
Right, yeah.
Go ahead, Tony.
That's well said. That, what you just stated there is exactly what I felt. We've already touched upon this as part of the essence of the last podcast, but just this constant either-or mentality, these gross generalizations about the use of the method, the implications of the method, NVC I'm referring to. He used the phrase, I believe, formula for managing another person.
Yeah.
Those are some strong words there. I mean, that phrase is pretty weighty to make such an assertion. Again, it goes back to intention. He assumes that if you're trying to use language to understand people's feelings and their emotions a little bit better and some requests for behavior or actions, that it's always done so with a nefarious purpose. I just don't see the connection there. I don't see, I'm not saying individuals can't use it that way, or even subconsciously might not be realizing that they are kind of leading the person into certain thoughts and certain issues, but you could do that with language outside of NVC. I see it done all the time outside of NVC, whether intentionally or not intentionally. I just don't see how NVC isolated is any better or worse than how people intentionally use language in other modalities. So again, I think he's making a stretch that NVC is a specifically being used intentionally or not intentionally as a formula for managing another person. It's just trying to understand the emotional realm, which is subjective, and trying to find words to express that emotional realm that we're always sort of suppressing and condensing down and trying to hold down like a pressure cooker, and it just wants to explode up. I mean, NVC seems like a pretty logical extension to try to understand what many of us try to hide away from, which would be the emotional side.
Yeah, the pressure cooker effect too. As those things become hotter, I'm getting frustrated, I'm getting upset, it actually starts to subtract from the logical flow, the rhetorical flow, even the identity flow of the conversation. That's where things start getting mislabeled. That's where logic can break apart. That's where rhetoric can become less effective, because there's this meta talk that isn't being addressed. I think that's pretty fair to say, because I've certainly had that experience in these kind of conversations where if there are intentions or emotions or biases that aren't addressed empathetically at the beginning of a conversation, it can run away with all kinds of misidentification, improper definition, two people using the same word but having totally different conceptions of what it means. So whether we're doing the intellectual or the emotional, identification up front is very, very important. And they kind of have to work together, and they kind of have to go back and forth. Anything else, or we can continue on with this for a few more minutes? Now, I do want to say in their defense that he does suggest, he says that not a formula, but you're a formula for managing somebody else's emotions. Is that what that's what you become in the conversation? I remember earlier on, he did suggest that there was this reveal coming, that most of us are doing this completely unwittingly too. We're not doing it as manipulators, we're being manipulated ourselves, kind of unconsciously using this process. So I do hope we get to that today, so we can see what he means.
But he mentions falsification again, to bring it back to philosophy. I mean, I think he's misunderstanding again, and I won't go into this like I did last time, but ethics and aesthetics, qualities to things versus universals in reality that condition everyone in reality. I think he has a major misunderstanding there. And also, you're not trying to necessarily guide your own thoughts or your partner's thoughts. I never used language or used NVC in such a way to lead my partner to a certain conclusion. We just used language so we didn't kill each other in that moment. And I'm using kill each other metaphorically, just to, you know, we were both so angry and so frustrated and so upset, you know, someone might have stomped out and, you know, not come back for a while. Just to stop situations like that, because at the end of the day, it's not necessarily like we instantly changed our behavior. Someone, we are still pointing out things about our emotional disposition and our behavioral disposition concomitantly that were issues. And we're just trying to choose language to make it actually observable and real for the other person without having the whole situation blow up. You know, two very different things. I will give him some major credit, though, because he mentioned something that's very important. He says, if you want to get down to where an argument usually goes awry, you can look at definitions. I 100% agree with that and think that's a very cogent point to make. I also like the fact that you can have similar definitions, similar viewpoints, but different values. It doesn't necessarily mean you're wrong or right. This is where judgment comes in. You can have a different value set, a different way you approach life, and your logic isn't necessarily inconsistent with someone else's logic. I mean, again, this goes back to aesthetic. It's a personal taste of how you want to live your life.
As prioritization.
Long as you're not going against universal instances of reality, like life and death and starvation or being able to provide food for yourself, things we need to survive. Now, as long as you're not going against those universals, everything else is a matter of taste of how you want to live. Do you want to live in a big city, outside a big city? Do you want to live in a smaller community? It doesn't matter. That's just all your personal taste. So at the end of the day, logic can have a set of conditions, a set of assumptions and propositions and syllogisms, conclusions that just say, hey, I like to live my life in such a way that is enjoyable and meaningful for me. that doesn't infringe on other people's universal rights. I think that's all he's saying. And so Trivium isn't just this perfect item that you can give people, and it's going to give everyone the exact same conclusion every time. Really what it should do is help you isolate universals that exist in reality and isolate what isn't any universal, what is more just an aesthetic, a matter of taste, a matter of subjective taste, and help you just analyze, you know, and mix the two and to lead a rewarding life. So I actually really give him a lot of props there for showcasing where the usefulness of the trivium, where arguments go awry and misunderstandings occur, and at the same time understanding that people do have different value sets, which is ironic because NBC is kind of set up as a modality for those who might be more sensitive or benefit from choosing language more appropriately and more consciously. And outside of that scope, I don't see it as a nefarious thing. I mean, it's just another tool. And I can see Jan struggling a little bit to try to condense down what Bill is saying, because Bill is actually stating a pretty consistent idea here that logic, in comparison with our values, can lead to different conclusions, but doesn't necessarily lead to evil or good behavior, like I just mentioned. And Bill, but Jan, on the other hand, it's so black and white. It's either or. It's either you have the general grammar that's this way only and can't be looked at and judged upon another way, and that's just the reality. And that's not the way things work. Things are just too complex to have a set of conditions that are always going to give you the exact same output for every single human being.
Right. Go ahead, Daryl.
Just wanted to add a little quick thing before the next segment, which was the usual thing is happening that I commented in the last podcast. We have an assumption of malevolence, an assumption that these are tools that are going to either unconsciously or consciously be used malevolently to change someone else to our own perspective, that we're managing another person is the assumption being made. And we, you know, since I hear Bill making that claim, and then of course I can understand that that's a concern as well. Yeah, if people are all using NVC tactics to get other people to their point of view, you know, I have to say, since I've definitely been floating around in various NVC circles, like both online and in person over here on the Big Island, I don't see evidence of trying to change other people's perspective. I see it as an internal tool of managing one's own terrain internally. And that's the way I see it. It's kind of like I don't see people using yoga anywhere to hurt people or to try and use their obvious now strength and flexibility advantage. You know, it's kind of like that, basically.
Right. Not even to win limbo contests on the island there, Daryl?
No, not even.
Using yoga. All right, so let's pick this back up. We'll see if they get into, you know, the other thing too that I was wondering about here is if this issue or this controversy originally touched off based on a perception that NVC was being used as a manipulative tool in some other issue, or if NVC was the target itself from the beginning. Was there some kind of debate that was going on some other issue and somebody said, hey, he's trying to use NVC to screw us up here? Or was NVC the whole battle from the beginning? I don't know the answer. I don't know if you do.
I don't know that I can easily answer that question, because that's the problem with the claims being made in both videos. I spent a whole bunch of time trying to write down claims being made, what was obviously a concern, tried to write that down too. And it jumps back and forth between specific instances, say, for example, their interface with me in the terms of the text writing back and forth on Facebook, and their interface with other people who use NVC skills, then the idea of looking at the skills themselves and making some type of conclusion that these things exist within the tools themselves. Kind of like when you get to the second video, you know, they'll be making all types of claims about what subtext is hidden within such things.
Sure.
It's about a moving goalpost, basically, you know, not like looking at one thing, like this is Daryl Becker using these skills specifically, regardless of what he calls them.
Okay.
And here's an example of his words, and here's what happens. There's a small example of that with like a paragraph breakdown of mine, but for the most part, it's going to be all over the place with claims. The concerns are real. People are out there using NVC skills, and people like Jan and Bill are out there receiving said skills on them.
Yeah.
And this is happening.
All right.
I mean, it's also, you have to understand, I think they're starting out with the assumption, a fallacious assumption of the genetic fallacy, where they're assuming that there's a shaky psychological origin behind NVC that sort of permeates throughout the way it's used since its development. So I think the assumption is inherently fallacious, and it creates that sort of either-or mentality, the generalization, you know, fallacies we keep running into. Because they're starting out with the assumption that it was nefariously designed to some degree, and even if it wasn't completely intentional, they make it seem like it's so obvious, and I just don't find that connection. So,
all right, so we will return to the video.
It's not for me to convince you to think like I do. It's for me to have a position, be able to back it up, and be able to express it. You know, so anything that we do, we have application. We have understanding and we have commitment. And on any of those levels, you can attack somebody's argument. Your understanding's off. You can't speak worth crap. I can't understand what you're saying. Or you're not committed to your idea. You're just ad hoc, wishy-washy. But if somebody has those three things, you can walk away from each other without there being bad blood and just say, you know, we look at it differently and I get where you're coming from and that's, you know, pretty cool, but I disagree. And that's fine. This is about taking your value set and manipulating somebody else into adopting it.
You're talking about with NVC, right?
Yeah. Okay. So I've got one last paragraph here about the denial of responsibility. It ignores the possibility that people can have emotional impacts on others. In the definition itself, it has a diagnosis with qualified language. So you notice that the language is never a firm stance. It's always a maybe or kind of or sometimes. A diagnosis of qualified language regarding the other person's inner state as cognitive emotional disconnection. It affords a convenient stance for the NVCer to regard a passionate argument as emotional disconnection. Intention, not content, is the focus. We're focusing on intention again. All right, let's fly through deserve-oriented language. Similar refusal or abdication as with denial of responsibility of an individual being able to respond to a given situation, usually represented as a cognitive and emotional disconnection within the individual. So again, we're back to a cognitive or emotional disconnection. So you're just qualifying the person emotionally and cognitively at this point. Punishments and rewards are often referred to while using deserve-oriented language. You, I deserve to, you, I don't deserve. Again, the definition contains a diagnosis of the other person's inner state. So the importance of this being a diagnosis of their inner state, it's a state that you can't verify. Well, you can't. The only way you can verify is to ask them, is that what you're feeling? And be able to trust their answer. You can't just make up that diagnosis, find a bunch of reasons to verify it, and say that you know it. There's no reality towards your assessment. So if a person's emotional response is becoming relevant to the topic at hand, if you want to know the diagnosis, ask them. You seem really upset about it. I don't get it. Why are you so pissed off? I'm just saying I like red Corvettes over blue. And then the person can tell you, and then you can come to different definitions and move the conversation along. Just ask. So it's a very arrogant stance. It reminds me of spirituality, where you take this moral high ground, like you're more spiritually advanced or emotionally mature or more cognitively developed, and then you take this condescending approach to everybody that you're dealing with.
Okay, so there is, I think this is worth repeating, that what they're trying to establish here is consistency between nonviolent communication and the trivium. Right. I said this in the last show. It's the same way behaviorists approached emotional psychology. They said it doesn't matter. It can't be proven. It can't be quantified. It's not verifiable. So let's just skip it and let's just measure behaviors. So when it sounds like they're discounting, in some respects, the emotional world because it can't be verified or it can't be quantified, it is in their attempt to answer this question, which, I mean, was answered, I think, for both of them before they even started this video presentation. NVC is not consistent with the Trivium method. But I don't want to, you know, because we're jumping into this at an hour and a half, make it sound like Bill is completely discounting the emotional world. And he's actually describing what I see as a part of the NVC process as a recommendation to ask, hey, what's up? How are you feeling? What's going on? And trying to get some feedback or some information that's useful in the conversation from the other person.
Well, first and foremost, the Trivium is a philosophical tool. Mm-hmm. It's a rational tool. It's not necessarily completely an empirical tool. It's understood by the laws of logic that are just observations from men denoting the processes of the mind, how it forms abstractions and how it forms universals and how it communicates these ideas through language. Certainly empiricism is behind it, or the method of induction and just observing each instance and trying to lead to a probable conclusion of what the human mind is and does. But it isn't first and foremost necessarily an empirical tool. It's a philosophical tool that uses many modes to describe phenomena. One is mythological or allegorical, analogical methods in general. The next one up would be rationalization, which is observing your reality and forming assumptions or propositions and trying to see if they're logically consistent. And third would be scientific experimentation, creating hypotheses, having a control group and testing against it and seeing what happens. So it's careful that we don't confuse the Trivium as though it's a completely empirical tool. It's a philosophical tool. It's about human reason. And human reason is really just, it's in between mythology and scientific endeavor, to be honest. It's the beginning process of the true scientific inquiry of the physical world. But it does not hold as the only or most advanced method in that regard. Reason is always needed after you discover something new. You need to come back and understand it and try to extricate the universal and communicate that to people so it can be useful. But reason by itself is not an empirical tool. And so he has to be careful if we're going to say the Trivium is this perfectly infallible tool, he's not necessarily saying that, but he is kind of stating that it's somewhat empirical, that it's only an empirical tool, and that's absolutely not what it is. It certainly rests upon a foundation of empiricism. If you're not a rationalist, if you're an empiricist, yeah. If you're a rationalist, yeah, then it's a different, you know, then you're trying to justify abstractions like God or mind or intelligence and stuff like that. So be careful how we understand the tool. Again, it can be a bit of equivocation if we don't understand that the Trivium is a description for the human mind, which combines reason and the five senses.
Right. Daryl?
I wanted to add that they were, of course, starting with the four Ds of disconnected communication, which is not the way you'd learn NVC skills at all. You'd learn O, F, N, R first. And if you're lucky, you might learn the four Ds. I talked to many NVC people. They've never learned the four Ds. And definitely Bill used my definition that I wrote up and sent to you, Brett, and then you got there posted on School Sucks podcast, the School Sucks Project website, mm-hmm. And that's where Bill pulled it from. And I used the term cognitive and emotional disconnection. And I used that term as a way of feeling empathetic for another person as well as for oneself. Everyone has cognitive disconnections and emotional disconnections, periodically at least. Some people constantly, you know, and so that was my, I was, what I got from that was, you know, in making this claim, what I'm trying to say is the claim was made that because I'm labeling people as being cognitively and emotionally disconnected, I am dismissing grammar. I'm dismissing what they say, which is of course not what I'm saying. It's a valid concern if I was actually dismissing everything they said because, oh, well, obviously they're just cognitively and emotionally disconnected.
That would be, if that's what you were doing, that would be a cognitive and emotional disconnection on your part.
Right. It would be because I would, certainly cognitively, especially because, you know, I'm trying to take in all the grammar. I'm never done with grammar work. There's always more grammar work to do. It's just that at a certain point, a decision is going to be made and action is going to be taken. And at that point, I'm going to be, you know, stopping grammar work just to apply myself to what is being delivered action-wise, in this case with words.
Right.
There's a sort of superficiality with the way they're describing these extreme circumstances. They're assuming that the emotional realm of the human being is pretty straightforward, and that it can't become overly complex. And because he brings up this example, red or blue, and I'm like, yeah, that's a matter of aesthetics. It's a matter of taste. You know, I shouldn't have to use NVC to be like, why are you pissed off today? Do you want the red car or the blue car? Oh, I'm pissed off because I can't choose. I want the red car. Yeah, I mean, I don't need to use NVC there. You know, that's common sense. But when I was with my girlfriend in a very heated moment, oftentimes we're using language to really just get under each other's skin, to say little jagging remarks that we knew was damaging to both of us. Sure. Then, you know, NVC was used essentially to communicate both our feelings and the problems we're having. And we're not trying to lead each other into each other's value system necessarily, the claim he makes there. Quite frankly, we're just using it to be able to communicate.
Yeah, to diffuse.
Yeah, right, you know.
So let's pick it back up. They are done with the four D's. And I think just to jump on what Daryl was saying, understanding this part that they lead with, an understanding of that really seems to be the product of going through identification, observation, feelings, needs, requests, OFNR.
Sure. It's kind of hard to isolate that claim in there. I think for the most part, the claim was being made that there's a dismissive, either conscious or subconscious quality going on with many NVC users. Like, oh, well, I have this skill and you don't. So therefore, I can just dismiss you as this. I'm writing you off. I'm analyzing you quietly and keeping it all to myself.
Right. All right. Here we go.
So again, the definition contains a diagnostic component regarding the person's inner state. This idea is linked to either or if-then propositions, which would be better worded as and also. So what are we doing here? What are one of the premises behind existence exists, or the law of identity? Law of identity is it's either is or it is not. It's either or. It's not is kinda and is not somehow.
She's kind of pregnant.
Yeah, we better actually deal with that right now. Either or versus and also in their bringing up existence in that case. Like when you say and also, what are you trying to describe?
I'm trying to describe a permissive and assuming benevolence type of attitude so that Tony can have his values and his perspectives on how things should be, and I can also have mine, rather than it's either Tony's or it's Daryl's, and one of us is wrong about how to perceive whatever it is. If we're speaking of something that's intellectual and something that's not an action-based thing that we need to make a decision on, and that's going to have, obviously, a very important repercussions.
So I'm
speaking of permissiveness. I'm speaking of not that concrete reality cannot be established or that conclusions cannot be held in common. We have lots of things that we hold in common, and some things are either or. Either I'm talking or Tony is talking or Brett is talking. But because, you know, we see what happens when we are all talking at the same moment. You know, it's not as awesome of a production. So it's one of those things where I was trying to also give the and also perspective regarding and also and either or. Some cases I'm using either or. Many, many cases I'm using and also. It's not either you're using either or you're using and also as a perspective. It's a tool. Again, the assumption is that I think that was in there. The concern was that I'm suggesting you're always using and also and you never use either or ever in any circumstances. Which I never claimed.
Which, and if you're talking about in the grammar part of the trivium, it would be, and I think that's kind of what Jan is hinting at there, that would be completely insane to do and also, like, across the board there. What you're saying lines up more with what Bill said less than 5 minutes ago about different conclusions based on different value sets and different perspectives, correct?
Right.
All right, Tony.
And different observations, because this is really a philosophical error they're making, quite frankly. They're employing a fallacy called the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. And all it means is that they're confusing the abstract and the concrete. What they're doing is they're confusing the axiom of existence exists with, later down the line, with qualities that we also know exist that aren't tangible, like love or happiness or fear or hatred or things like that. Their existence exists is about material implication, that there is a material world bound by the laws of cause and effect that is pretty much an either or. Something either exists physically or doesn't. This goes back to Aristotle's category of substance. And I won't get into a long philosophical diatribe. We've already done shows on that. So if anyone's interested on understanding sort of the beginning rules of logic and the trivium, Brett and I did a couple of shows, Logic Saved Lives shows, that kind of went over those beginning concepts. So I won't go into them now, but they're confusing the axiom of existence and its concreteness with then abstractions later on. So abstractions are just when we go through life and we encounter something, we extricate or take properties out of the things we perceive in our reality and create a mental image of them, a mental understanding of what these things are. Why that's important is because in those abstractions, things that were either or in physical reality can become also and in different ways we look at things. You could use an example maybe of a building, like a piece of wood is not a rock. But if you bring a piece of wood and a rock together, you could have wonderful masonry and carpentry and make a beautiful house. So, I mean, it's a weird and a strange example, but I'm just showing how depending on the relative way in which you're going to use these things, anything in reality can be either or also and depending on its own context. And I think that's so important. And so they're really confusing a philosophical axiom with really abstract assumptions later on that NVC is dealing with, which is trying to understand using language that a lot of these either ors with subjective qualities, emotional subjective qualities that we internally are bound by or trying to release from can be viewed either way, depending on the context. And that's why I like Daryl's perspectives, because the way in which we choose our language and view these different things happening in our lives that are creating these different behavioral and emotional dispositions can actually be looked at in a completely different light as an also and. Maybe we're trying to grow from a breakup, or maybe we're trying to understand what's holding us back from really giving into life and being happy and giving into the moment and these sorts of things. I don't know. I'm just trying to, you know, just bring examples as to when it comes to subjective qualities, you can, but depending on context, they can be taken as either or also and depending on what you want out of life. Okay. And so that's way more complex than the beginning axiom of philosophical discourse, existence exists, which is just a matter of literal existence, literal tangible existence and substance in Aristotle's terminology.
Yeah, and just for review, I mean, we've talked about this on the show before, but these three axioms, usually tied to objectivism, existence, consciousness, and then identity. And distinguishing that from three metaphysical laws, identity, causality, and non-contradiction. And causality and non-contradiction essentially come in the logic portion of the trivium.
Right.
So let's go back to the video.
Okay. And then it converts them to and also statements. This is a direct attack against the law of identity in your own speech. If I don't use if then, either or, I'm also not taking a very definitive stance on what my position is. If I say and also, maybe kinda, what I'm doing is I'm dissolving obfuscating my position, which leaves a person in an uncertain ground. Who am I talking to? Where are they coming from? They can't assess that.
All right, so at this point we've spoken to this, but we'll let them go.
So this is really about stepping away from solid definitions. It's moving out of the definitions. It's getting wishy-washy. So this idea undermines the language of cause and effects. Changing propositions this way changes the meaning of your statements without changing the content. And that affords you two things. It allows you to change the definition mainstream if somebody responds to your argument, or it allows you to back out of the position if you realize you can't win. slippery definitions like patriarchy do that. They shift the definition anytime somebody comes up with evidence against it. So this is about making slippery definitions. So how can you value the trivium and then start mucking around with definitions, the meaning of your statements? Okay.
I'm going to move on. What are we on, 27 now?
Yeah, we're going to move on to 27. Okay, this is OFNR, observations, feelings, needs, and requests. It's this area that I think a lot of people that are interested in the trivium are attracted to NVC. Not only that it helps win arguments, but it seems to line up with grammar, logic, rhetoric. So it's a procedure. You're supposed to begin with observations without making any assessment of them. Identify your feelings, state your needs, or identify your needs and make requests and so on. If we look at this picture, there's some meta messages behind this picture. If you look at the inputs, we've got two inputs. I'm going to have to blow this up so I can see it here. If we look at, there's two inputs. External objects go into observation. Then we have need strategies, and we have the cognitive mind. The cognitive mind is defined as perceptions colored by, what is it? I can't read it. Age, thought, visualization, judgment, view, and opinion. So cognitive mind is colored by thinking, judgment, view, opinion.
And notice the loaded language there, colored by.
Exactly. And needs and strategies are at the top, because one of the premises behind nonviolent communication is needs are never in conflict, only strategies to fulfill needs are. But it's up there top, up top there, and you can see there's no connection from observation to anything else. That's a meta message. Now we have another input at the bottom. Get this. We have breath, which moves into feelings, and we have spirit, which moves into feelings in the body.
So,
okay, where does this graphic come from, Daryl? Do you know?
Ouch. It comes from me posting it a couple years ago on your site, I think, and somehow it stayed there. And I'm sorry. You know, there are much better OFNR graphics out there that certainly don't include breath and spirit and things that I'm sure many folks who came to enjoy our productions from the objectivist camp, they would have a little problem with that. And I can, you know, and I understand, because it's very vague.
Yeah.
No, I grabbed it from the internet. I liked how it included many messages, many variables. I liked how it included many variables to consider, but it's absolutely can be easily confusing to many people. Certainly, I can see how it's confusing to Bill and Jan. This is how some people would use NVC. You could find this graphic certainly easy enough on a Google image search. I think maybe you could certainly find it on School Sucks Project website, since that's where Bill pulled it from. And there are much better ways that I would wish to convey these ideas, unfortunately. The idea that observations are not connected because they're not connected in this particular graphic is an interesting assumption, isn't it? It's like, this is the graphic, this is what NVC people are using, and this is the only version of it, and that's it.
Yeah, that's why I asked, because I've seen lots of OFNR flows, and none of them ever looked like this. I mean, this one is fairly groovy looking, you know, and it does have, yeah, a few things that raise questions for me. In fact, I'm doing a Google image search. Oh, yeah, that is the one that comes up. There's one here that shows it going around in basically a circle, observation, feeling, need, request, observation, right? Which is, right. I think, all five of us involved in one way or another in this production would agree that that's probably a better representation of what a better flow for this would look like.
I would just say from my experience that here's how I see it if I was going to make a speculation on how myself and other people work. Mm-hmm. Observations include the five senses and any thought that you can actually put into tangible words. It's all of those at once, basically. It's everything like that. And that flows through the value and desire filter, or in NVC speak, needs. That's how I see it. It flows through the filter of how you're doing with all the things that you value and desire at that moment. And that is what produces the emotions, which is your cue to then take a moment to think about your actions, which is how I like the last part, instead of calling it requests. When I've mentioned this to certain other NVC users, they've said, well, the request could be of yourself. And I was like, yeah, that request could be of yourself. But most people, when they use the word request, they're thinking of other people. And when they use the word needs, they think of the adjective needy. So thus, I don't use those terms much. But that's going to be very common for many NVC users to use those terms, because they are sticking to what was given to them in their training, which is the terms needs and requests.
Okay.
I like values, and I like strategies and actions. So that's how I see it as far as in actuality. Now, the way it's taught is you can observe things, including your thoughts, and that's tangible to some degree. If you can write down your thoughts, they become tangible. Your five senses, you're doing your best to, you know, as the video camera takes in, like all three of us talking right now, we've got this recording, and you can go back and look at the recording, listen to the recording. And that's a tangible thing on the tangible side. You can notice your feelings. So this is the way it's generally taught. NVC skills are taught that first you notice your observations, then you notice your feelings, and then you try to extrapolate what the values and desires and needs are that generated those feelings, so that you can maybe make a good decision of action, which might include a request, hopefully of yourself, possibly of others. And unfortunately, many people are taught this as just a request of others, which is a problem.
Sure. Tony, anything to add before we go back?
I think Daryl covered most of everything. I would just make a note, and I could be wrong about this, so the audience can look it up for me. But I believe etymologically, the Latin root of spirit, whatever that word is, I think means breath or to breathe or something like that. So there is actually a connection with spirit and breath. But yeah, I can understand how that can be misconstrued and taken way out of context. So
yeah.
Other than that, I like the OFNR model for the claim that Bill makes, insofar as the people who are into or enjoy the trivium or found the trivium to be useful seem to get latched here. It's at the OFNR model, because it's a consistent model that kind of moves linearly.
Mm-hmm. And
it actually moves more spirally or in a circle, but you know, you can kind of go from this position to this position to this position in one fluid movement. And so, it, you know, you look at it like that. I mean, there is definite comparisons to the trivium and the same sort of modeling, where it's a consistent fluid movement from each step. Even though it goes in a spiral fashion, it's, you know, always goes grammar, logic, rhetoric, so forth and so on. It goes back to grammar. And you kind of keep learning in this sort of spiral pattern. OFNR is, you know, pretty much matches up with that same sort of pattern. So yeah, that was when I first saw the OFNR model. I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. It seems to be congruent with the trivium, at least from a model perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And since it started out with observations, I'm like, grammar, observations, pretty much the same thing. Really, definition. So you're just trying to define the inner world of the subjective versus the outer world of the objective, which is what, at least the way Bill and Jan often refer to the trivium. That's really the way in which they use it, which is, there's nothing wrong with that.
So. I did want to just translate this into audio here, a part of this graphic. Obviously, a demand is a dead end, which you just mentioned something similar to that. But in this left column here, it says, words can be walls or windows. Starting with observation, and observation is an objective description. It is not an interpretation or a label attached to a person's behavior or attached to the person, his or herself. That moves on to feeling. I'm feeling wonderful. I'm feeling miserable. A feeling is distinct from a thought. And they're using do not equal signs here. From feeling, we move on to a need or a universal requirement. There's plenty of lists of these on NVC sites broken down by different categories. A need is not equal to a strategy. And from that need and an understanding of that need comes a request or a strategy, an attempt to connect, to be clear, to be empathetic, a request for action, concrete suggestion, who, what, when, etc. A request is not a demand.
Right. A request does not need to be a demand. I think that, again, it goes back to that understanding of context, where they state that it's either, in their definition of existence, for example, it was either it's this or it's that. A rock can't be a piece of wood and a piece of wood can't be a rock. But the human mind, through logic, can put the two together and to a context where they both can exist together to support one another. So although as physical units outside of us, one can't become the other, but through human imagination and reason, we can combine the two and make them useful. I think it's the same idea with NBC. You know, it doesn't always have to be an either or, depending on context, the way we review or view or try to explain our internal subjective feelings to other people. You know, oftentimes, I think, especially in negative internal feelings, we kind of get stuck in that thought loop where we're constantly berating ourselves for actions that we perceive maybe put someone down or put ourselves down or something like that, when that's actually not the truth. We're taking an either or perspective because our emotional disposition almost demands it. But when we're able to open up and use different language and have people to bounce ideas back and forth with, you know, oftentimes they can help show us that, you know, that all either or in a different context and a different understanding can become an also and. And that's why I think it's important to understand these models in context.
Absolutely.
We have to appeal to emotions, which negates number one, which was observation.
Well, what's spirit? How are they defining spirit? What does breath have to do with it?
Do you mean scotch spirits or?
Yeah, exactly. So again, we've got inserted in here. We're starting to get into where the misintegration comes in.
And so what we see here is they're using potentially fallacies of equivocation, because, you know, what is spirit? What does that mean? Breath, okay. Breath.
And how is that related?
And how is it really? Yeah. I mean, what is it? It's a nothing. It's, you know, under the trivium, under relevance presumption, fallacies of relevance presumption or ambiguity, it would fall under relevance. And right. Ambiguity, for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And ambiguity is a big part of this. And if you look at the bottom of the F circle there, feelings and emotions, so we go from observations to feelings, and there's no connection between the two. We have at the bottom, happy and satisfied, and then that moves into an affect, honesty, desire to connect, empathy, sincere intention, compassion, and so on. You guys can read the slide. Which then leads into a skillful request. Okay, so the output of this is to make a skillful request. Wait, if I'm feeling happy and satisfied.
Let me just point out something right here, because that number one, the O, goes to itself. So you have an observation, and then you go, and I'm going to put that over here in the back of my mind because it goes nowhere. And then you're going to focus on breath and spirit to come up with a skillful request.
Rest. That's right. Now, if you're feeling anger, fear, or sad.
I'm changing it to 1.25 so we can kind of speed through this since we've already addressed it, since there seems to be a little bit of an understandable hang-up on the spirit and breath part of this. So it's going to cruise a little faster.
Again, none of this is based on your observation or knowledge.
Because observation is totally separate from any of the rest of the diagram.
Yeah. That's right. Then we move into shame and no choice, attachment, strategy of outcome, desire to control, and so on, which then leads into violence, tragic expressions of unmet needs and demands. Okay.
You know, this diagram here just makes it so blatantly obvious that nonviolent communication is complete garbage.
Yeah. And I'm sure some will say, well, I don't agree with this, or that's not really how it works. It's much more nuanced. At the end of the day, what's driving the effect are two things. Your emotions. It's either going to drive you to anger and control, or it's going to take you down into respect and empathy. It's one. So the feelings are driving your actions. So if you watch the meditation video, how do we define emotion? But when we were confronted with a conflict of information, the conflicted with the definition of self or world, when new information came in that you needed to assimilate, that you're resisting, it's negative. If you're assimilating, it's positive, right? Right. That emotion is not information in and of itself. Emotion is just your reaction to information. So how has NVC got anything to do with choice when the legs that you're standing on is that everything that you're going to do is going to be based on your reaction to information? Whether it's positive reaction or negative reaction, it's still an emotional reaction. It's treating emotion as though it's information in the world. Not information about you, but information about what's going on in the world.
Right.
It also ends in either demands or requests. And this is there's an underlying assumption here that your needs are met through other people. It's not action. It's not skillful action. Skillful action, skillful requests, skillful collaboration. It's skillful requests, period. How is it, where is it in here, skillful instruction? It's only demands and requests. So there's an underlying premise here that takes us away from the idea of independence and over into a thing called interdependence.
Isn't that a little bit of overstretch there, making it's all about NVC? This is how our needs are met by effectively communicating with other people. This is like one arena of getting certain needs met. This is not the whole picture. This is right. One part of it. I think that's important. I did want to let that play out a little bit, unless one of you guys already know what he's going to say about these two ways that he was describing. All right, I'm going to go back a little bit because I really wanted to catch that and make sense of what he said, but I think I missed it.
Right, can I just...
Yeah, please.
That needs are met through other people. That's mm-hmm. important right there. That requests are the goal. That requests of other people are the goal. I see this in some NVC teaching that goes on. I was just friends with someone who was over at, let's say, a farm that takes interns. Someone who's like new to the island shows up there. And everyone who's working on this farm as an intern is required to learn this version of NVC, where they're stating their observations, their feelings, what they are after as far as their need, and making a request. And it is cumbersome as all hell. And none of them learn the four D's. And so many of these requests can be taken as a de facto demand or as a unrequested diagnosis or as an attempt to communicate that they deserve something.
Mm-hmm.
Any of these things can be communicated and interpreted by people who are new to this language. This is a very intimate language that I mostly emphasize as internally used to create balance and to make choice. And that's why I change needs into values and desires for the most part, or motivating factors for the most part. And that's why I change requests into strategies and actions, because that way I've neutralized it to a capability of seeing what's going on. But it's a very important thing is many of these people who are using and learning NVC are indeed, in my opinion, being taught to go towards interdependence and to stop, like, and to not necessarily use these skills to manage their own terrain, which is independence. That's essentially a valid claim that I would say. And, you know, like, and I can definitely imagine that some NVC practitioners might take objection to what I just said there. But I think that it's incredibly a valid claim that many newbies are coming in, especially in, you know, interesting circumstances, taking their first NVC group or class, and getting a meta message that it's all about the requests of other people, that you can meet your own needs through other people.
Right.
That's ironic because I never got that implication about how requests are always on other people. I actually found it that the request oftentimes was to myself to change a behavior, to be conscious of my language, be conscious of my emotions at certain times, which leaves me with unparalleled amounts of choice. So when he says, how is NVC choice? I'm sitting there like, well, hell, in my own life, I used it just to give myself choice in the way I react to my own emotions. That was my own request to myself, or a request that at the time my partner had made to me about observation seesaw and my controlling nature in certain areas. So it was great feedback. I mean, it gave me so much more to grow on, to go on and grow from, that I never looked at it as though I'm using it to manipulate other people to make sure they do stuff for me. I request something, they do it. It's like, that's so one-dimensional. I can't believe it's even, Bill is presenting it in this one-dimensional model only. And interdependence, I mean, so many people, and Brett, you yourself just came from Porkfest. There's nothing wrong with being in a voluntary society and wanting to be interdependent with one another. If it helps, you know, your chances for survival, if it helps, you know, share creativity throughout a community or a social group. Like, I just don't, interdependence has this sort of, has these negative connotations.
You're right.
Today,
yep.
You know, but that's not a bad thing. It, again, context. I'm coming back to context. Either or also, and what depends on the context in which you're relating different concepts. And so I think in this case, interdependence at all is not a bad thing. I witness it a lot of times in the voluntarist communities, where they are, you know, they're independent, but also recognize the value of interdependence when they come together.
Well, that's, I mean, that's kind of what's implied there. Inter is, okay, so inter is between versus intra, which is inside.
Right, yes.
So interdependence, it has the word dependence in it, and people say, uh-oh, that's a bad word. But interdependence is there's give and take, there's mutually beneficial exchanges. So it's not like I'll die without you. It's that we both benefit from each other. I mean, maybe there is a better word for what I'm picturing that just isn't used there. Because, yeah, I mean, dependence implies a lot.
Symbiosis in biology.
And trust. Yeah, there's trust yeah. involved in it as well. But you're right. It does have a connotation of being a very dirty word.
At least amongst some people, especially in some more extreme, maybe libertarian or alternative-minded people, interdependence, you know, as you mentioned, between, which is a bit of a give or take, depending on context. Again, there's nothing inherently negative. There are no underlying connotations that say this is inherently, universally, essentially a bad thing. It just means that it has no inherent meaning unless there's some context behind it, unless there's some one-on-one back and forth between the parties involved. It's just more complex than these very simple either or one-dimensional descriptions of the way in which these tools are being used.
Yeah. And one more note on that. Most healthy relationships have some element of interdependence in them, even
yes,
if it manifests in somebody saying something like, I can really depend on Tony, or I can really count on Daryl. And it's not like I really depend on Tony. It's different. Right. That's worth pointing out. All right. I wound it back just a little bit so we can catch what Bill says about these two ways, which I do want to pay some attention to here.
What's driving the effect are two things. Your emotions, it's either going to drive you to anger and control, or it's going to take you down into respect and empathy. It's one. So the feelings are driving your actions. So if you watch the meditation video, how do we define emotion? But when we were confronted with a conflict of information that conflicted with the definition of self or world, when new information came in that you needed to assimilate, that you're resisting, it's negative. If you're assimilating, it's positive, right?
But
emotion is not information in and of itself. Emotion is just your reaction to information. So how has NVC got anything to do with choice when the legs that you're standing on is that everything that you're going to do is going to be based on your reaction to information? Whether it's positive reaction or negative reaction, it's still an emotional reaction. It's treating emotion as though it's information in the world. Not information about you, but information about what's going on in the world.
Right.
It also ends in either demands or requests. And this is there's an underlying assumption here that your needs are met through other people. It's not action. It's not skillful action. Skillful action, skillful requests, skillful collaboration. It's skillful requests, period. Where is it in here, skillful instruction? It's only demands and requests. So there's an underlying premise here that takes us away from the idea of independence and over into a thing called interdependence.
All right. Maybe there's really not much to unpack there, and we can actually just move on.
There is, if we want to read between the lines, he's essentially saying there's almost a predeterminism with emotions, that based on the information, you're going to have either a positive or negative reaction emotionally to whatever information is available, and it's going to drive your actions. And then the second part of the equation is that there's demands and requests. And he makes a strong point that in the second part, so there's really only two parts to this. There's emotions and requests, is my understanding of what he's trying to distill it down to. And so the request portion is, it's not, you know, instructions or how to be better, you know, and other things. It's just requests to other people. He makes a major point to, and we kind of already covered it a little bit, Daryl and I, so I'm not sure we need to touch on it. I think there's a misunderstanding on his part though he's almost presenting the emotional display as though it's predetermined based on information alone, and it can't be viewed again and under a different light or different context. So besides that, just acknowledging that it's not just about requests to for other people to do things. It could be requests for yourself, or it could just be stronger acknowledgments about what drives us. But we talk about this with David Allen stuff. We mentioned, I think, last podcast as well, but just the idea of the mind to put a label on it, to categorize something and understand it in a different way or under a different concept or in relation to different concepts, can have a completely earth-shattering way in which you then view that emotion, that feeling, that concept, that whatever. This stuff isn't predetermined. It's not always simple. You know, there are some variables and complexity to this depending on the situation. It just seems a bit watered down the way he presents it, as only this or this, again, this either or, and how limited the emotions are. It's just a reaction to information. It's either good or bad. And NVC somehow predetermines the way in which you'll make requests based on those emotions. And I think that's just so far from the understanding of what, at least the way I was taught about NVC through Daryl.
So. Yeah, and they've kind of run away with being misled by this infographic that they were looking at, because, you know, the conclusion that we were trying to figure out that Bill is making there, if we're correct, is that observation is just completely disconnected from the whole process. It's just right. It's just there as kind of like to fill space in the graphic.
It doesn't go anywhere, as Jan says, or whatever, right?
Exactly. So that's a misinterpretation that's understandable based on, you know, just looking at OFNR through this graphic alone.
Right.
All right. So I think we've cleared that up, and I think we can move on.
Observations without evaluation. And then note, previous image states perceptions colored by ego thoughts, judgment, views, and opinions. So perceptions are colored. And then the next one is feelings. Note, no mention that emotion may color observations, which you pointed out.
That's a pretty blatant omission there too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because most would say that emotions color perception.
Right, not the other way around.
Yeah. Needs, motivating factors.
Daryl, do you want to comment on that?
There's no mention that emotions may color observations. I'll just say I've mentioned it. I've said that I'm not the only one who's mentioned it. I'm pretty sure Wes Bertrand has mentioned it. Many NVC users have mentioned this, that many people are consciously or unconsciously looking through the filter of their emotions and their feelings. And the claim, this connects to the previous claim in the last segment of essentially NVC users are claiming that emotions are driving all of your actions and you are helpless to change this fact, basically. So we're just, you know, like NVC users would just be making that assumption as if you're helpless to deal with your emotions.
It's frustrating.
And that's, of course, the exact opposite of what the whole skill set is about. It's about
exactly.
Trying to be aware of what's going on internally and maybe making choices of action that might lead to more predictable and desirable results.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Thank
my
you.
Claim would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's very, because again, that predeterminism based on the emotional disposition, NVC is about analyzing and understanding your emotions, again, under a different context to give you more choice. Again, expanding that room between stimulus and response, right? That's all this is.
Exactly.
Are all motivating factors based on needs? Are interpreting or expressing needs relevant to all topics? Is the outcome of my communication always going to be a statement of needs and fulfilling needs? So this is another core assumption behind nonviolent communication, is that all human actions are a strategy to fulfill a need. And that, and now you mix that with the idea that all needs are met through other people. What have you done? You've just disempowered the person. I have to rely on others to have my needs met. And everything I do has an underlying need. So I'm needy and I'm powerless.
Right.
Requests, actions. Is a request of action always required, which we've gone on to. So what's the underlying assumption? Needs are met through other people and interdependence. And interdependence is a key one that we'll get into with the history of things. It ties into Bateson and cybernetics. Mm-hmm. Okay, so on slide 29, I lined up.
Pardon?
Interdependence is tied with Bateson and cybernetics. I guess we'll get into this in episode two. I'm sorry, but that's just such an unbelievable statement to make.
Go ahead and expand on it.
I mean, just they're assuming there's this countercultural response since the 60s to form this interdependent society. Many conspiracy theorists that are looking at more from the liberal side of the spectrum will say, no, there's this movement towards interdependence, this movement towards cultural Marxism, these sorts of ideas. Interdependence, when you view the way the term was used through the 60s, 40s, 50s, and especially in the 60s and onwards, it was defined so ambiguously and it's so equivocatory based on the populations using the word and the different ideas of the people using those words.
It definitely has a euphemistic quality to it, for sure.
Yeah, that too. It's euphemistic. It has equivocation. I mean, each group, whether it's cybernetics or the technologists, what became out of the cyberneticians, the cyberneticists, the word can be defined so many different ways. And oftentimes these people actually believed that interdependence was something to strive for, something, you know, good to relish. And honestly, it comes out of the systems thinking. You know, ever since, you know, the fall of religion during the end of the Enlightenment, these secular ideas of utopia, that this goes back to the 19th and maybe even going into the 18th century. Once, you know, the religious powers fell to reason and then reason fell to Immanuel Kant, you have this continual succession of trying to create secular utopias. Cybernetics is just another one. Cultural Marxism is just another one. And interdependence is a word used in all of them and defined completely differently by all of them. To make such a broad statement about the way in which people use that word, but many of them use it with purely good intentions, even though the intellectual systems theorists of the time they believe they were doing the right thing by using that word and this idea of creating a perfect system of flow and feedback, you know, a closed system. And this is still a philosophy in high regards in academia today, systems thinking. This is never going to end. The idea of trying to create a perfect system, hell, Plato, the Republic 2,000 years ago, Francis Bacon, the New Atlantis or whatever. I mean, these are no new ideas. So when he makes a broad statement about interdependence, and like this is just Gregory Bateson and the whole philosophical history is about interdependence, utopia, systems. This is nothing new.
I was wondering, do you feel like a person might be more understanding of their position and maybe some of their presentation here if they actually watched the second video first? Like, I just feel, having seen both of them, that where they're coming from would make a lot more sense if you had the historical context that they're dealing with. I just think that after having seen the whole presentation and then going back to this second half of the first video, it makes so much more sense, the suspicion, the vigilance, their whole attitude towards, and because it's kind of like, where is this coming from?
Right.
But then when you see the second video, even though the second video, I think we're going to find, is deconstructible in many parts as well, in many key parts, but it just makes so much more sense after you see the whole thing.
Yeah.
So
you can understand where the assumptions are coming from.
I wanted to add one little thing.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead, Daryl.
All human actions are strategies to fulfill a need is a claim that I would gather many NVC users would make. I would just be more specific. I personally speculate that all human action is a strategy to fulfill a desire or something that is valued, an abstraction. So in other words, that's very similar. Or it could be actually a physiological need. I go to work to earn money to get food and continue being lodged in this place. You know, I mean, that's my strategy, is to fulfill the needs for safety and security and, I would say, stability to some degree. And those are values and desires of mine. If I wanted to have less safety and stability, I could choose to do other things. I could choose to just live in a tent on the beach. But instead, I choose to do what I do. And then, therefore, I achieve what I achieve. It's kind of hard to argue against that. I can't really, you know, in fact, it's one of those statements where in this whole video, it's like, wow, Bill just made a very obvious statement. Everyone is doing things to achieve some abstract goal. And can you tell me that are people doing things that aren't to fulfill an abstract desire or value or an actual physiological need? Because I can't see it. I mean, so I will put it, that qualifier on it. I speculate that that's the driving force behind all action, human action.
Couldn't the trivium just be, couldn't we just supplant NVC with just, let's call it the trivium? I mean, hell, I mean, it's an observation. It's a general grammar stage for observing feelings instead of tangible objects, maybe in reality. But, you know, the trivium deals with feelings. It deals with concepts. It deals with tangible things. And, you know, there's no limit to the way, you know, how we reason necessarily, especially when it comes to the imagination. So we could just replace the NVC with the trivium. It's the same method, essentially. I mean, you're observing essentially subjective qualities and feelings instead of just like tangible objects, maybe in reality. Logic isn't devoid of analyzing and critiquing or judging subjective qualities. In fact, there's a whole section in my one logic book I use that just goes over, you know, why, you know, happiness is universal, love is universal, hatred is universal. Like, these are essential qualities of the human experience, but they're qualities, you know, they're extracted from the experiences we go through, but each one's a little bit different, you know. And so it's not like logic doesn't already handle these ideas, these concepts that are intangible. So I don't understand why you just can't say, well, it's called the trivium, which can handle these intangible qualitative aspects of our lives, and we can, you know, just grammar, logic, and rhetoric in the logic stage would just be essentially the feelings and the needs and requests, I guess.
Well, that's what I think. That was the presentation we
feelings
made.
Feelings and needs.
That was the presentation that we made at the end of 2013, and I feel like that is part of the thing that touched off this whole debate and this whole controversy, you know. And I feel like I've kind of sat here listening at parts of this, feeling a little bit guilty because I picked the title for that series. Daryl didn't. And I called it The Trivium Applied to Communication. And you know, one of the real authentic explorations that I wanted to do here was, did Brett pick the wrong title? Because, you know, maybe I did. Maybe it is not The Trivium Applied to Communication, but it's the same process. The Trivium, NVC, right. Even the Six Pillars of Self-Esteem or Getting Things Done.
I-A-I-A.
Yeah,
right.
It is observation and identification, part one. Part two is acceptance. And integration. So I use acceptance because that kind of incorporates an emotional component into it versus, you know, thinking about ourselves like computers, input, process, output. So it's observation and identification, step one, acceptance and integration,
yep,
part two, and action and intention, part three. So the trivium and NVC don't have to be the same thing. And we don't even have to be having this debate, like, do they line up? Or at one point in this earlier in this video, they say, can you replace the rhetoric portion of the trivium with NVC? I don't even know where that question hatched from. But if I am responsible for suggesting, and I am responsible for it, and I think I'm wrong, actually, at this point, they're not the same thing, right? But it's the same, they're both using the same process that the mind is naturally inclined to go through, but for different ends. One is
the same
more
process. That's the key thing. It's the same. The mind is using the same process, regardless if we're talking about the six pillars of self-esteem or getting things done, the trivium or NVC. The mind is analyzing these tools using the same process, because the trivium, or really just rational thinking, is a description. It's not a prescription. It's a description of how the mind works. That's been commented on for over 5,000 years, going all the way back to ancient India and the five-part syllogism. This is nothing new, or the dialectics of ancient China. And then ultimately moving into the Mediterranean, ancient Greece, and so forth, and then moving, you know, into the medieval realm and the Catholic Church when it became the trivium. But at the end of the day, it's just a description for how the mind works. I feel like that's the one universal here, as that although we can look at them, NVC is different from the trivium, but the trivium is just the description for how the mind works. If we're going to go with that definition, and essentially, then it's not incongruent with NVC. It's just how you analyze NVC and see if it's valuable or not valuable. It's how you analyze other things and other methods, other getting things done, six pillars. It's the same sort of method. So yes, they are congruent. I don't see you'd use this method to analyze and review anything. So to me, I mean, I think Tragedy and Hope also mentioned merging, like in our production, merging the Trivium with NVC. I think yes. we had some sort of title like that. I don't see, they're not incongruent. If the Trivium's just a description of the mind works, then we're just using how the mind works to analyze and use NVC. So I don't, you know, that's my biggest, I think my biggest pet peeve with Jan's presentation and use of the Trivium is that it's this static tool. And that it's not dynamic. It doesn't change based on the situation. That's always this one way. General grammar is always going to be perceived to be the same with every single person. Logic will always be consistent and the same with every single person. I commented upon this last time between, you know, Kirk and Spock. It's that dynamic, I think, showcases the difference in thought is that, you know, within logical thinking, there's going to be there's variables, there's a whole dynamic process that can change the outcome that reason, cold reason alone can't always gather all the information necessary. So when you turn cold reason and combine it with NVC to try to understand some of the emotional side of things versus just the cold and tangible, straightforward cause and effect side of things, you know, it just gives us, it just expands our realm as a human being. Beyond this sort of cold empirical viewpoint to also the understanding, empathetic, and subjective sort of qualities that also drive us. I know that to me, I don't think your title is incongruent at all. I think it's very much analogous to and works with NVC or any other method because it's just a description of the mind. Certainly, we can draw different conclusions maybe using the Trivium that how NVC might or might not be useful. You know, we could argue that. Or give Jan and Bill that sort of credit and assumption. But as far as whether or not it's congruent, I think that's an absurd statement because the Trivium honestly is used for everything. It's just whether or not you're making it. We oftentimes said this. It's whether or not you're making it explicit or you're just using it implicitly. People all the time are using reason implicitly. But there, something does happen to the mind when you put a label to it. When you put a label to a fallacy and you hear, you know, the news and some politicians talking like, oh, I know that's this fallacy. And it just something about making it real and bringing it to the forefront of your mind rather than just having that intuition, like something doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
That is a whole world of difference. When you finally have that confidence to know that's why I always feel so unsure about the way those people are speaking because, oh, they're using this fallacy, that fallacy. So now I know the next question is, are they using it intentionally or not intentionally? And, you know, once you assess that, you know how to judge the danger or damage that might have been done from it. So,
sure. Daryl, do you want to weigh in on all that? That was certainly a lot, but your thoughts. You can go all the way back to the title of our series if you want.
I was happy, and still I'm happy with the title of our productions in 2013. And that is because we began in that production with going over the Trivium.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought it all back to that at the end of that production.
All right, fair enough. All right, let's go back to the video.
I think people look at this and see some alignment with the Trivium, where they see observations and feelings as sort of data collection about yourself, and that lines up to grammar. That my needs or my motivating factors is really my logic or my dialectic. And then the request is my output of sort of self-awareness. Now, I think Trivium can be applied in terms of self-awareness, without a doubt. I don't think this would be the application of it. Like, you can use the Trivium, what are the what's of an emotional state that I'm having, or even the thoughts and stuff I'm happening, which can develop nuanced understanding of, you know, when there's tension in my chest here, or, you know, when my jaw clenches, it becomes precursors to certain filters on my thinking and so on. It can be used internally. I'm not saying that that's not the case.
All right. So that lines up with what you were actually saying, Tony, a few minutes ago, I believe.
Right. Yep.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. I mean, it's at this point, we kind of already addressed that, but yeah.
Yep.
It's good.
What I'm saying is that NVC is not a replacement for the Trivium applied internally. It's a corruption of it. So it's observations and feelings, really the data that you're dealing with. If I had to identify my feelings as being, well, I'm feeling vulnerable, is that really data? Or is that a reaction to the world? And if I want to look at my reaction to my world, it would, with the Trivium, it would be something more along the lines like, when I'm, okay, so I'm feeling vulnerable, what is the data of that in my body? What's the proprioceptive sensation? How is that affecting the envelope of awareness? Like you can go into that, but you can't stop at feelings being the data of grammar, right? So if you want to use the trivium as sort of an internal pursuit, it's about identifying things. And as you do that, identifying things internally within your own awareness, if you want to do that, it's moving into more nuanced effects of those sensations in that awareness. It's not stopping at the top. It's digging down.
Okay, so now we're seeing, and this is where maybe some of the Gnostic media listeners who might be checking this out run to their fridge to get eggs and tomatoes. But I even think that there is some lineup with some of the stuff we've been doing more recently, like internal family systems therapy, and how that actually ties to neuroscience. So that internal family systems therapy, I'm still working on this, but it seems to fit the identification, integration, and action model as well in many ways. In this book that we were covering in the last series we did on adverse childhood experiences, there was a lot of talk about what neuroscience is telling us. So to say the emotions aren't information or the emotions aren't data, those lead us to further explorations that can provide tons of information that can also now, we're finding, be backed up by brain scans. And the example that we gave in the series was in internal family systems therapy, the suggestion is that our self is composed of subselves, and different situations trigger different parts of self to come to the fore. If there is a trigger that sends a more of a child self, a less mature self, equipped with less emotional and interpersonal problem solving skills to the fore, this all sounds very new agey and fruity. But you can actually see in neuroscience that a different part of the brain lights up when that happens. It shifts from the prefrontal cortex to the amygdala, you know, right. Developed part of the brain. So I'm not sure that Bill and I are disagreeing here that the emotions contain significant amounts of information, but there's further to go. If we're just stopping at, like, I feel sad or I feel scared, I agree with what he's saying there, but that is still incredibly useful.
Well, he's making it seem like the trivium is more nuanced than NVC, and I believe it's in the context of its own use, because I mentioned earlier that through NVC, and I guess using the trivium as well in this case, because I don't see any difference, as I mentioned earlier, I was able to make requests for myself to analyze behaviors and emotions that I never looked at in a certain context or perspective using NVC, and also the trivium really combined with that. So they're both just as nuanced depending on the context of its use. So he's trying to make NVC out to be this very pretty, very smooth, coarse sort of tool, but underneath it, there's no substance. But the trivium somehow does have this. And both are just on the context of its use, how far you can go. You know, to go back to the idea of neuroscience, we know that there's a measurable response from the limbic system before the prefrontal cortex kicks in and tries to logically understand the signals it's receiving from the nervous system to, you know, the limbic system, and ultimately, obviously, the amygdala, which is really the primal. So even before the limbic system, we know there's a measurable response before our logic even kicks in.
Well said.
A lot of recent psychologists have been on this point. You know, David Allen talks about this a little bit too, because he developed his whole system from neuroscience, or from the most recent revelations in neuroscience and psychology, or at least the harder aspect of those soft sciences. Well, one's a soft science. Soft science would be psychology, but neuroscience is also showing, like you said, similar. We know there is a measurable effect from the emotional part of the nervous system, limbic system in specific, before it reaches the prefrontal cortex, the neocortex in the front, to rationalize it. And that right there can color even the use of the trivium. If we know there's a measurable response to the emotions first, how much is that driving or coloring just a little bit the way in which we then use our logic?
Yeah, it's so, kind of a short circuiting almost. It can be. And this is the space. And this is why, exactly, I think that this exploration is so important. Most of the time we jump over the space from stimulus to response. We're not just sitting there watching the news. I mean, it's certainly possible, but I think the most emotionally invested situations involve our interactions with other people. So that's where it's most important, I think, that this space is created in our relationships. And that's, I mean, really in the end, I think that's what it's all about.
Well, you talked about the 14 different types of intelligences that exist out there. I want to say it's 14. I forget the doctor who came up with that. Part of intelligence, you know, the 14 different and possibly many more categories that exist, has to take in emotional intelligence, intelligence that doesn't come through verbal communication, which is usually communicated through, again, the nervous system. With the different types of intelligence that exists, that shows that to be a total human being, it's a multidimensional and dynamic process. It's not this very static, cold, do this one process the exact same way every time, and it's always going to give you this almost this exact same result. I think what we're trying to say, Brett and Daryl, is that the human being, soul, spirit, the internal abstract part of the human being that we don't know how to define, psychologize, maybe, at the end of the day, that's very dynamic, and there are many different ways to approach the human complex. It's not just reason alone. It's not just the emotions alone. It's all the different ways in which we perceive a reality, take in information, and understand it through our own filter. I think, you know, especially with all the different types of intelligence, it just shows that the human being is much more complex and dynamic than we think it is. And so to understand some of these triggers, these foundational triggers, like the emotional response will happen quicker than logical thinking. That's important because that gives us at least an opportunity to tell or for our little voice in the head to be like, you're angry right now and you're rationalizing certain events in your mind out of the anger first. And you're, you know, but just making it a little bit more explicit, a little bit more acknowledged that this is a reality. All of a sudden you take just a little bit more ownership and can possibly control and hopefully change from that realization. I know all this information, all these different tools, we're just trying to give people as much space between stimulus and response as possible. I think that's all we're really trying to do in the alternative media, especially those who have gone through enough of the history, enough of the philosophy to understand that ultimately I think it starts really with the individual first and foremost. Then it expands out to the different spheres of influence that we have in our reality. The human being through this presentation is being presented too simplistically. And what we're not doing is bringing it into a totality of what it means to be human and the complexity that it brings with it. And that's why I like giving up to neuroscience and these other ideas as well. I mean, Gino Denning, who presented the Trivium to Tragedy and Hope in Gnostic Media, he drew a large portion of his understanding from the most recent neuroscience available, especially to show what we call synaptogenesis, which is a massive explosion of synaptic connections in a child's brain. And he showed this to be concomitant with the sort of general grammar stage where they're just taking in massive amounts of information and making tangible, literal connections in the brain and the nervous system with these ideas. And if anyone wants a video to watch, I'll have to post this to you, Brett, but it's like this brain science video where it shows this man tries to learn how to ride a bike backwards or something. Like the, instead of like you turn the bike right, it goes left. So the whole operation is backwards, essentially. It's reversed. And so what he shows that it takes him like, I don't know if it took him 3 weeks or a month or a couple of months until he's able to retrain his brain, but his son, who had already learned how to ride a bike and was still around 9 or 10 years old, was able to pick up the bike and within a week or two change those patterns in his mind. And so it just showed how different it is, like from a child to an adult. And this is why I always say, like, when it comes to what Stefan says or other people about, you know, adverse childhood experiences, we just mentioned that, get it right from the beginning, and that the adult has so much less to fix and so much more opportunity rather than breaking the individual early on, then they have to spend the rest of their life finding ways to fix, you know, maybe the psychological disposition or from a health standpoint, you know, the food they were given to the child, you know, all these things. If we just get it right from early on, you have a much better chance later on than trying to reverse the damage later on from what happened early on. So,
well said. I'm going to let Daryl take us home today. If you have anything else you want to add at this point.
What we see in the video so far is, I would say, going back and forth between looking at tools and then imagining that the tools are actually driving the person.
Yeah.
So that the tools are, at one point, the tools are looked at as tools, that you're looking at the components of the tool and how it's built. Although I think we found some criticism in how the tools are looked at, that they're obviously missing very important components of it. Here's a little quote that I wrote down from Bill Jocelyn just a moment ago. You can't stop at feelings. No one in the whole NVC user world suggested to stop at feelings. In fact, that's just an aspect of finally actually paying close attention to them and maybe putting that in as a subjective variable. And there's the thing again, going back and forth between subjective qualities and objective measurable situations. This whole thing has been much ado about tool sets and making, I would say, some conclusions and blanket statements, and we've been slowly addressing them. I think it's really important work that we're doing.
Listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.